For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. On today's show, we'll be chatting to Tracy Lien about her debut novel, All That's Left Unsaid, a tale of moral minorities and murder in Cabramatta, Sydney. We'll also talk to Talking Books narrator, producer and Luke Skywalker's best friend, Biggs Darkleister himself, Garrick Hagan. All that and more on today's Read On. All That's Left Unsaid is the debut novel from Tracy Lien. It follows a young Vietnamese-Australian woman who returns home to her family in the wake of her brother's shocking murder, determined to discover what's happened. Very emotive and moving, it's a dramatic exploration of the intricate bonds and obligations of friendship, family and community. I'll talk to Tracy in a moment, but first, let's hear from the audio version.
The circumstances of Denny Trun's death were so violent that most people in Cabramatta were too spooked to attend his funeral. At least, that's how it seemed to his big sister, Key. The funeral hall had been all but empty. Her dead 17-year-old brother lay in the glossy closed casket. Her parents and a few relatives kneeled next to a blown-up photo of a grinning Denny, and a Buddhist monk chanted prayers in exchange for lunch. The only non-family in attendance were Denny's high school teachers, who huddled together, big-eyed and confused by the lack of seating and eulogies. At the wake, they stood in the doorway to her family's narrow townhouse, still holding the flowers and signed cards they'd brought to the funeral. No one had told them that Vietnamese families take cash, and waved at Key like they were getting a waiter's attention.
"Hi, Key!"
Mr. Dixon said in a voice that was too cheerful for the occasion. His mouth stretched wide in what appeared to be an effort to correctly pronounce her name. He'd always called her Kai, even though she'd corrected him in Year 8 when she sat in his math class 4 times a week. "Key," she'd said, her voice small. "Like a key that unlocks a door?" Maybe it was amnesia, but every time he read the class roster, she became Kai again, and after a third correction, she gave up. Key, Kai, whatever.
So All That's Left Unsaid is a murder mystery. It's set in the year 1996 in Cabramatta, which is a Vietnamese refugee enclave in Sydney, Australia. The story begins when a 17-year-old boy is beaten to death at a Cabramatta restaurant. And when his older sister returns home for the funeral, she learns that the police are completely stumped by her brother's case. About a dozen witnesses were present, and they all claim to have seen nothing. So she takes it upon herself to track down each witness to find out what happened and why they each refused to speak.
Your sister is Key Tran. How similar is your background to hers?
I think on the surface level, like a lot of people who have read the book have asked me, like, you know, to what extent are you Key? Is Key you? Because we share a lot of surface level similarities. For example, you know, we both grew up in the Cabramatta area. Our parents are refugees from Vietnam. And I think the thing that people draw like the greatest connection to is the fact that I used to be a journalist and Key's character is a journalist. So they're like, them. It's you, isn't it? But we're actually very different in many ways. For example, the novel is set in the year 1996 when Key is 22. In 1996, I was 8. So her experience of Cabramatta and her upbringing is very different from mine. And in fact, she's from a different generation. And then also the family dynamics are completely different. You know, she's an older sister, whereas I'm the youngest in my family. Our personalities are quite different. You know, even though we're both quite introverted people, I think her level of anxiety is much higher than mine has ever been. And, you know, I think a lot of the friendships that I have given her, a lot of the relationships she has are quite foreign to me. Like I've never had a friend as intense as Minnie, who is her best friend in the novel. You know, a lot of the situations she finds herself in, I've never been in. So I really did take advantage of the fact that this is fiction. I can heighten the stakes. I can put characters in situations that are you know, quite foreign to me that I had to research in order to write them. So I'd say there's some superficial overlap, but we're very different people.
Can you explain what a model minority is?
Sure. So the model minority is a term that was coined in the 60s in America. And it was used to describe, I think at the time, it was Japanese Americans. They were cast sort of like in contrast to other racial minorities, specifically Black and Latinos. And it was really a tool for oppression, because in talking about the model minority, writers in the 60s were saying, look at how good the Asian Americans are. Look at how hardworking and quiet and law-abiding they are compared to the other minorities. And so, you know, this idea of the model minority has kind of found its way around the world, where I'm pretty sure it exists in the United Kingdom. It certainly exists in Australia, where Asian Americans, Asian Australians, Asians in Britain now sort of have this pressure on them to be perfect. You know, the Asians are the successful ones. The Asians are the quiet, hardworking ones. And the problem with this myth of the model minority is that if you buy into it, you believe that if you are just really well behaved, then you will earn an equal place in society and you will be treated with fairness and respect and dignity. But then the problem is like, but what if you don't adhere to the criteria of the model minority? What if you're not quiet? What if you're outspoken? What if you're not exceptional? In fact, what if you're just a really ordinary person who's at times lazy? Or what if you're capable of failure? You know, what if you don't live up to those impossible standards? Does that mean that you are no longer worthy of a fair go? So my novel tries to challenge that myth, this idea that if you're just good enough, if you just behave well enough, then you'll get a chance to belong, then you'll be treated fairly. And I think my novel is just pushing back against that and saying, well, no, that's actually not quite true.
Hey, Key said, rushing to clear a spot on the coffee table for the flowers. She could feel the teacher's eyes scan her parents' living room, identifying everything that was familiar to them. Panasonic television, years-old McDonald's Happy Meal toys on top of the VCR, Key's framed university degree, photos of Denny winning highest academic achievement 4 years in a row, and everything that was unfamiliar. The ancestral altar that featured black and white photos of her unsmiling dead grandparents. A bright red calendar hanging above the television reminding them that 1996 was the year of the rat. A doorway full of shoes. The other teachers, whom Key recognised as Ms. Faulkner and Ms. Buck, continued to study the room, smiling at Key's younger cousins, one of whom grimaced in response. Are your parents around? Mr. Dixon asked. Mum's in the kitchen. Her mother had stayed up the night before, hand-rolling more than 100 buns for the wake. Key helped stamp the tops of the buns with a spot of red food colouring, but expressed scepticism about her family needing to prepare so much food. Because even though she'd been away from Cabramatta for 4 years, she knew how this town worked.
Now, the book is narrated by three different people. Who are the three main voices in the book?
So the narrators are Aileen Nguyen, Yen Nguyen, and Amelia Nguyen. And the voices, it's interesting because there are actually more than three characters in the novel. Key is the protagonist, but then she also encounters all the witnesses who were there. So we get to see and hear from their point of view. And so Aileen narrates all the adult women characters, Yen narrates all the men, and Amelia narrates the one child in the novel who's a 10-year-old girl named Lulu Wu.
Was it the publisher's choice to use three narrators, and did you get a choice of who you had reading it?
It was the publisher's choice, or it was their idea, and I was fortunate enough to get to listen to the audition tapes, and they asked for my opinion, and yeah, the people I liked most happened to align with the people that my publisher liked most, so it worked out really well.
Now, I've heard you giving readings of the book. Do you not fancy being one of the voices yourself?
So the thing is, having listened to a lot of audiobooks, I think the people who are able to pull it off have a soothing quality to their voice, like a voice that you could listen to for 9 hours or longer. And I think that at a certain point, I start to sound a little bit like a Simpsons character. And I'm not sure that that's tolerable to many audiobook listeners. So I'm glad that my publisher went with professional actors, because I think they bring something to the performance. You know, they are, especially in Aileen's case, you know, she not only has like a very listenable voice, she brings a sense of humor to the performance. She, you know, is able to capture the emotion really well. And I think, yeah, they do a better job than I could ever do.
Just when you mentioned sense of humor there, is it hard to balance the quite heavy subject material while still keeping it fun?
It wasn't, if only because I think that there's a goofiness to life. I think, you know, people fart at funerals, for example. Even when something tragic is happening, there is always, I guess, there can be levity to a moment. So, you know, growing up in Cabramatta, like coming from a family of refugees, you might think, wow, that's really heavy, you know, what your family has been through. And it's like, that is true. But my family is also hilarious. You know, when they get together, they are razor sharp. They will jump on a joke as soon as there's an opportunity for one. Or even if you listen to, like, overhear young children speak, you know, no matter what's going on at home, even if they have a very difficult home life, they have a lot of sassiness about them. Like, there's nothing quaint about 10-year-olds or 8-year-olds. So I was just very aware of people being multifaceted in that way and communities being multifaceted in that way.
Now, does the audio version sort of influence your writing? As you're writing, do you read the book back to yourself?
Oh, absolutely. I think a lot about rhythm when I write. You know, it's not just about the words on the page. How they sound really matters. And I, in the revision process, will read the book aloud. And that it tends to be how I catch repetition, but also like just a clunkiness in the rhythm. My advisor at the University of Kansas, when I was working on this novel, she was telling me that once she finishes writing a draft for her novel, she'll record herself reading it from start to finish. And then she'll listen back. Like when she goes for a walk, when she walks the dogs, she will listen to herself reading it back. And that is how she catches a lot of what's not working. So yeah, I think there's so much to the rhythm of a sentence, the rhythm of a paragraph, whether it makes sense to repeat something or to repeat a refrain 3 times versus 4 times versus 5 times versus, you know, whatever it might be. So yeah, absolutely. Like audio is a big part of it.
Do you listen to audiobooks yourself?
I do, especially if it's memoir and the author is reading it. I much prefer that to reading, you know, the text-based version, because I think they just bring such a warmth and so much more feeling to it. So one of my favorite audiobooks, well, is anything Anne Patchett reads. So her essay collections, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage, and more recently, These Precious Days, you know, hearing her read her own stories, it's so comforting and wonderful.
So what sort of novels inspired you to write this one?
That's a great question. So quite a wide variety of novels inspired this. When it came to having the courage to write about an issue that I really care about, so that of, you know, a refugee community in Australia, I drew a lot of inspiration from authors like Viet Thanh Nguyen, who wrote The Sympathizer and The Committed, because I think seeing someone depict with such honesty a community that I was familiar with, a community that, you know, in his case, he's writing about Vietnamese Americans and the Vietnamese in France. But, you know, these are communities that normally I thought, oh, we don't get written about. Is it because we're unworthy of being talked about? Are we unworthy of novels and other forms of media? And seeing him do it so well and receive, you know, so many accolades for it definitely gave me the confidence and the encouragement to step out and give it a go myself. And then once I decided that I wanted to do it, I looked at a lot of murder mysteries and thrillers for inspiration, because I just thought about what are the kinds of books that I can't put down. Like, as soon as I begin them, I need to whoosh right through them. And they were books by like Jane Harper or Trent Dalton or Leon Moriarty. And so I turned to those books to sort of try to understand what was it about them that gave it that page-turning quality, and what could I learn to use in my own novel.
Now, you were a journalist covering some quite technical things. Was it an easy transition to writing a novel?
Initially, it was hard because as a journalist, you're not allowed to make anything up. And as a novelist, that's all you do. So it was, I think it was more of like a momentary identity crisis. Like when I decided I wanted to write fiction, I was like, am I allowed to do this? Like, will the fact police come and get me? But after I got over that, the skills that I learned from journalism were super helpful. For example, the discipline required to write, you know, a novel, the shortest novel I came across was around 60,000 words, which is roughly 200 pages. And I remember thinking, okay, as soon as I just need to get to 60,000 words and then I'll have a novel, whether it's any good, who knows, but 60,000 words is my target. And the longest thing I'd ever written as a reporter was maybe 3,000-4,000 words. And so I was like, this is so daunting, so intimidating. How do I approach this? And it truly was discipline, because I think discipline is far more reliable than inspiration. As a journalist, if I'd waited for inspiration to strike before I wrote, I probably would have gotten fired. So, you know, I used that discipline to just write a little bit every day. And by writing every day, it became a habit. And once it became a habit, it was no longer intimidating. Other things that were helpful, like I was very comfortable with research because of my journalism background. So I'm writing about 1996 Cabramatta, which is, yeah, at this point I'm 8 years old and I have an awareness of what's going on, but, you know, I've like vast knowledge gaps. So I just did a ton of research. I read news clippings from the time. I read ethnographic papers. I did interviews with people who lived and worked and were associated with the drug trade in the 90s in Cabramatta. And all of that, you know, informed my novel. And then there were other elements as well, like, for example, being able to pitch my novel when I wanted to sell it, when I wanted to find a literary agent. You know, I think journalists typically have to pitch whatever they're working on to their editor in order to get a green light. So I had a lot of practice there, and I brought that to my novel as well.
And it not only got pitched, it was part of a 9-way auction. How was that?
It was full on. So the novel went to auction in the US and the UK. And it was a fairly similar process in that the editors who were interested would get on a call with me. And each call went for about 45 minutes. And the structure of each call was very similar as well, where the first 15 minutes they would tell me what they liked about my novel. The next 15 minutes, they would tell me all about their imprint and how they were different from others. And then the last 15 minutes, which was possibly the most important portion of the meeting, was they would tell me everything that they wanted to change about the novel. And the reason that's so important is because it largely informed my decision. You know, do I want to go with the publisher who thinks that this is good to go, you know, minor tweaks and we're ready? Or do I want to go with the publisher who wants me to cut like half my characters and write this novel in a different genre? And so there was like the spectrum of requests. And it was also a chance for them to get a sense for how open I would be to the changes that they wanted. Like if they proposed a bunch of changes and I was like, absolutely not, then the decision would be made for both of us. So it was a matter of like getting on calls with each of those editors, having those conversations, taking a ton of notes, and then talking with, you know, my literary agent about how I felt about each person and which imprint would be a good home for the novel. And HQ in the UK ended up being the best fit for me. I really enjoyed my conversation with Manpreet Burrell. And yeah, it was wonderful, but very, very overwhelming as well.
Now, the book's out just now. But one thing we don't get as blind or partially sighted readers, or don't get in general if you're downloading the audiobook, is the cover. Can you describe the cover to this?
Oh, what's so interesting is that I have three different covers, one for the US, one for the UK, and one for Australia, and they're very different from each other. So the British cover is bright red, and the text for All That's Left Unsaid is in gold foil. So the texture is very pretty. And along the edges, it's very subtle, but you'll see the details for the Joss paper that is mentioned in the novel. One of the motifs of the novel is the burning of Joss paper. So in Buddhism, there is a belief that, you know, when someone dies, you can essentially burn offerings to them so that they have material goods in the afterlife. And sometimes this takes the form of Joss paper money. Sometimes it can be gold. Sometimes people get very literal and they'll burn like Joss paper clothing and paper mache or like origami servants. So on the UK cover, along the border is sort of like the detailing from the Joss paper money. And at the bottom are sort of flames swallowing up that cover. So from a distance, you can't really tell what it is, but up close, if you're really paying attention, then you'll see those details. And then the Australian cover has a lucky red envelope in the center that has been crumpled. And so a lucky red envelope in Asian cultures is symbolizes sort of good luck and good fortune. And it's normally given as a gift with money inside at weddings, birthdays, the Lunar New Year. So any sort of celebratory event, you would give someone a lucky red envelope. So in this case, the lucky red envelope is crumpled and the detailing on it though. So normally on a lucky red envelope, there might be like Chinese text on it. But I've seen lucky red envelopes that have Hello Kitty on it as well. Like they really vary. You can put anything on it. So when I was having conversations with the Australian design team, I was like, I'd really like to find a way to make this cover not just Asian, but Asian Australian. Because my characters are Asian Australian and the setting is Australian. And this really is, to me, an Australian story. So they came up with this idea to put cockatoos and waratahs on the lucky red envelope. And it's one of those things where non-Australians don't notice it, but every Australian who has looked at the cover has said, oh yeah, I see the cockatoos, I see the waratahs, I notice these Australian motifs. And then the American cover is very bold, very colorful, almost somewhat abstract, where there's like blue to represent the sky, there's red to represent the earth, and then there's round, you know, yellow sun, and then waves at the bottom. And I think the colors remind me of Australia. And yeah, I think each cover is just perfect for their respective markets.
If a family suffered a good death, the kind that happened to old people, the kind that everyone was prepared for, the Asians in town showed up with family members in tow, gifting envelopes stuffed with cash. But if it was a bad death, the kind caused by terrible luck, where children or gangs or heroin were involved, everyone was suddenly too busy, was out of town, or hadn't heard the news. Her own parents had pulled a similar move on friends and acquaintances before, claiming that they were tied up with work when really they were superstitious about bad luck rubbing off with proximity. "This is different," her mother had said, after Key questioned who would eat all the food they were making. She refused to look Key in the eyes when she spoke. She refused to acknowledge that Denny had suffered a bad death, the worst kind, a nightmare that stole her words and silenced her family. She refused to stop moving, as though afraid the truth would catch up to her if she slowed for even a moment.
All That's Left Unsaid by Tracy Lehn is available in print, as an ebook, and in audio wherever you buy your books. And Tracy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Tracy will be back at the end of the show with the books of your life.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB, see differently.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Reading or listening to a great book is an important part of life, whether it's for education, to give you a laugh, or to just get lost in an adventure. Well, RNIB's Reading Services online library is here for you. Listen to a book on your phone or tablet, or just tell your Amazon smart speaker to play your latest talking books.
To search for a book, say find followed by the title.
Or if you prefer Braille, download a book and read on an electronic Braille display, such as the Orbit Reader. Search for RNIB Reading Services online or call the RNIB helpline and tell them that you're interested in the reading services or any of the other great RNIB services we offer. The helpline number is 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
Hello, I'm Ray Sawyer. I've been reading for the RNIB Talking Books for 25 years now. My first book was Coming From Behind by Howard Jacobson, but the one I think I enjoyed most was Writing Home by Alan Bennett. Not just because it's wonderful writing, but although not officially an autobiography, you've got a sense of his life as all his selections of writings were put in chronological order. I particularly like The Lady in the Van. The Talking Book studios, as now, were very close to where Alan Bennett lived, and I was able to walk up and actually see the driveway in the house in which the lady lived for 25 years. And quite by chance, Alan Bennett was sitting on his front step reading The Guardian when I turned up.
This van, there were to be three others in the course of the next 20 years, was originally brown. But by the time it had reached the Crescent, it had been given a coat of yellow. Miss S. was fond of yellow. It's the papal colour. And was never content to leave her vehicles long in their original trim. Sooner or later, she could be seen moving slowly round her immobile home, thoughtfully touching up the rust from a tiny tin of primrose paint, looking, in her long dress and sun hat, much as Vanessa Bell would have looked had she gone in for painting Bedford vans. Miss S. never appreciated the difference between car enamel and ordinary gloss paint, and even this she never bothered to mix. The result was that all her vehicles ended up looking as if they'd been given a coat of badly made custard or plastered with scrambled egg. Still, there were few occasions on which one saw Miss Shepherd genuinely happy, and one of them was when she was putting paint on.
I love doing the talking books because, well, you get to play parts that you'd never get to play in real life. In fact, doing a book is a bit like doing a one-man show, only one that's 25 hours long.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. And where would those talking books be without our narrators?
Garrick Hagan has narrated more than 130 talking books for the RNIB Library. Fans of Stephen King, Tom Clancy, James Patterson and many other best-selling authors will recognise his voice immediately. But that's far from his only contribution to the world of storytelling. He and his wife, narrator Liza Ross, run The Story Circle, a leading audiobook production company. And among his many on-screen credits is his role as Biggs Darklighter in Star Wars: A New Hope. So, when he popped into the studio, my only problem was where to start. Garrick Hagan, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
So, today you're here at the RNIB studios in your capacity as a producer. I was looking through the list, you've produced over 150 audiobooks of all genres. That must make you one of the most busy audiobook production companies in the country, I would have thought.
Oh, that's a nice thought, but I try to mix it with my acting work. and so it's always taken up spaces in between acting jobs. But I have been lucky because I've had a whole series of excellent books and wonderful readers. I've been privileged to work with, for example, Ian McKellen, Julie Walters, Joan Collins, Charles Spencer, many, many people who I wouldn't have met in my normal workaday life. And I consider that one of the great benefits of producing, aside from the fact that I've had an awful lot of very good books to do. I could go on forever, but the one big starting point to the success of the Story Circle was working on His Dark Materials, Philip Pullman's book, and we did that over a number of years as he kept writing them, and I did that with a whole full cast productions on each one of the books in the trilogy.
That certainly brought the kind of ensemble actor cast that you get in radio drama into the world of audiobooks, which is something that I can't remember having been done before, and really brought the book and its many characters completely and utterly to life.
Yeah, the producer was Tim Ditlow in Random House, a well-listening library in New York, and he had been working with Bruce Colville, and so he got used to doing multi-voice productions of children's books. And he heard some of the productions we'd started with. My daughter had the idea of us doing point horror books from Scholastic, and they were short enough and involved children's characters. And so we were able to adapt these stories very easily and well and present them rather like old-time radio. I grew up in radio. When I was a kid, I worked in Canada on CBC radio a lot, very young. And I always remembered those days with great fondness and wanted to reproduce them when we did Point Horror. And we did 8 productions for Scholastic, and they were all... I still look back on them, and believe me, I couldn't believe it. They're on YouTube now. Some of them have been just uploaded onto YouTube, without pictures, of course, just as our productions. And they're quite old, but they're still listened to and enjoyed.
Tess saw the figure as just a blur, but something struck her as strange. Instead of rushing to the boardwalk to help, the figure was moving away from the scene. Was it going for help, Tess wondered? But why not use the phones nearby? And what was it doing under the Devil's Elbow in the first place?
They asked for it. They did. They had it coming, all of them. They get no sympathy. They think it was an accident. Wrong.
And today you're in the studio working with another multi-talented man, Mark Billingham. You're recording his latest Tom Thorne.
Yes, it's the newest one. He's just written it, and we're actually recording it. And Mark is discovering commas and slight things he's changing as we go. But he's a wonderful reader, and as you say, he's an actor as well. Comedian as well, so he's a wonderful ear. And we've worked together on a number of his books with him narrating, and also done a book. The last one that we did was Love Like Blood, has a number of other actors in it who also work with the RNIB quite a bit. And that, I must mention, a lot of the actors I've worked with have been either trained or read for the RNIB, and it's a wonderful place to gain experience for actors in general, you have a lot of professional actors who have read for years. It's a great company to draw on for actors in other productions.
Well, I sit just outside the green room and I listen to you on your coffee breaks and your lunch breaks, and the richness of the voices and the stories. And you're clearly a very close bunch. You clearly meet each other quite often at the RNIB studios and at other studios and swap your stories and the tales of the books that you've been narrating.
Yeah, everybody always asks, what are you reading? What are you doing now? But it is nice when you meet outside the RNIB. It's like meeting another club member, if you like. Say, where have I seen you before? Oh, yes, it's the RNIB. Isn't that wonderful? And I met Sean Phillips last weekend at a convention, and, you know, she's another reader, Richard Franklin. So people that you often meet in conventions who you don't realize have been readers, and then you suddenly have a bond.
There also seem to be quite a lot of former actors from The Archers. You, of course, played the rather rascally Simon in The Archers. And recently I was talking to Caroline Lennon, who described herself as the Irish slapper from The Archers.
Quite we were both rogues in our various ways and both ejected finally.
the Archers rogue survivors. Maybe there's a series in it. You never know.
Well, I've met Graham Seed here, who was had that epic fall from the roof, and there are an awful lot of RNIB actors who have also worked on the Archers. And I did a production of Alice in Wonderland here. Roz Adams worked in that, as did other Archer's actors. And Richard Wilson. I had Richard Wilson in that. So, yeah, it's a wonderful community, the voice community anyway. And especially I must put a word in for the American, Canadian, or altogether North American actors who read here and read elsewhere. I've done a lot of work with them over the years. It's been a wonderful place for me to connect with other actors and actors to meet with each other.
Now, I was scrolling through a list of the talking books that you've narrated at the RNIB, and do you realise you've done over 130 of them? And a large number of Lee Child, Tom Clancy.
Yeah, large books.
And one of my personal favourites, actually, Killer in the Rain by Raymond Chandler.
Oh.
You really do seem to have Marlowe's laconic, world-weary voice down to a T. Do you have a favourite that you've narrated?
I guess my favourite book in an adult capacity was John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, and partly because, well, it's such a moving story, and it's a meaningful story. It has such resonance with the life in early 20th century America. So it's a great book, that's all. And I was very moved myself by the end. I know you shouldn't be moved when you're reading a text, but I was extremely moved reading it.
I think most readers would say it's actually quite difficult not to cry at the end of The Grapes of Wrath. And
yeah.
Yes, I can imagine it must have brought a lump to the throat. Most of the books I mentioned were thrillers, but as you say, you've narrated a lot of classic literature and actually some factual books as well. I was reading something about the reconstruction of Baghdad recently, which
I
had
know.
Your voice.
Yeah, when I think of it, I wish in a way that I could remember the wonderful non-fiction books that I've read so I could quote some of these facts, because of course Iraq has come up so often in our conversations, and that was a wonderful book. I only regret not having a photographic memory. One of the major fiction books I've read, and one of the best American writers, was John Updike, and that was a great privilege, because I did the Rabbit Trilogy, and then I wrote to him and I said, you know, I am so pleased to have finished with Norman Mailer's Harlot's Ghost. And this was for the RNIB. And I said, I'm so pleased to be getting on to your book, which was a book of essays equally long as Harlot's Ghost, over 1,000 pages, both of them. And John Updike wrote me back a little note, because I sort of played on the fact that he wasn't a great friend of Norman Mailer, as far as I could understand, and I got this nice little note back. Nothing against Norman Mailer, but just appreciating the fact that I appreciated getting into his book after Norman Mailer. And then when I met him, he came over for a talk, and I lined up and met him, and he said to Garrick, he wrote in his book, "The only man in the world besides myself who has read every single word of Odd Jobs," which was a lovely little inscription.
Now, your wife, Liza Ross, is also a narrator and works with you, is co-founder of the Story Circle as well. Mm. Do you discuss the books that you're narrating and producing between you? Do you have similar tastes?
Liza reads a lot more than I do, just reads for leisure more than I do. I seem to be working on books that I'm producing. But Liza is great at organizing, so she schedules the multi-voices and does it rather like a film production assistant or location manager, all combined. And that's a great facility, and it works terribly well. And in fact, The Man on the Mountaintop, she actually directed. I, in the end, didn't direct it myself. That was with Toby Jones and Stanley Tucci and a cast, and she did a marvelous job. So she's not only a good reader, but she's very good adapter and organizer and, in fact, directing.
And is your house full of books, paper copy books, or are you electronic readers, or do you listen to audiobooks?
Well, we have a house full of books, which we're rapidly trying to get rid of because nobody wants them anymore, and we're going to move. But, and Liza reads an awful lot now on the Kindle. I am less on a Kindle. I like paperback and books and the paper itself. And occasionally we listen to audiobooks, but we don't have a great deal of time. We don't even listen to a lot of the books we produce in the end after editing them and finished. That's it, because we're moving really always on into other productions. And right now we've got another multi-voice, which we hope to do here at the RNIB, that we want to do. So we're lucky in that sense. Audiobooks have meant a great deal to us, and it's been a great addition to the acting work and all the other voice work we do. We've been extremely lucky in that respect.
And you mentioned the acting work. I couldn't conduct an interview with you without mentioning Star Wars, the gift that keeps on giving as far as you're concerned, really.
I've got to thank Star Wars for taking me to places I would never have been. It lives on for us veterans because we go around doing conventions occasionally. And like next week, I'm off to Denmark, and then I go to Albuquerque in America and so on. It's just fun. And the fans are pretty fantastic. And some of them actually come up and say, "I've listened to you on audio." And I had one chap up in Scotland, he came up and said, "I've just finished Tom Clancy's The Bear and the Dragon." And gosh, that was 26 hours. So there's a nice crossover. Yeah, I got to say, old big Starglider comes roaring into play every so often. And I love meeting the people who still remember that character.
Well, big Starglider, Garrick Hagan, thank you so much.
Great to talk to you.
Killer in the Rain. We were sitting in a room at the Berglund. I was on the side of the bed, and Dravik was in the easy chair. It was my room. Rain beat very hard against the windows. They were shut tight, and it was hot in the room, and I had a little fan going on the table. The breeze from it hit Dravik's face high up, lifted his heavy black hair, moved the longer bristles in the fat path of eyebrow that went across his face in a solid line. He looked like a bouncer who had come into money. He showed me some of his gold teeth and said, "What you got on me?" He said it importantly, as if anyone who knew anything would know quite a lot about him. "Nothing," I said. "You're clean, as far as I know." He lifted a large, hairy hand and stared at it solidly for a minute. "You don't get me. A fella named McGee sent me here. Violets McGee. Fine. How is Violets these days? Violets McGee was a homicide dick in the sheriff's office. He looked at his large hand and frowned. No, you still don't get it. I got a job for you.
My guest, Garrick Hagen, narrating the title story from Killer in the Rain by Raymond Chandler. For a full list of talking books narrated by Garrick, go to the website rniblibrary.org or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5.
And now it's back to Tracy Lien for The Books of Our Life. Now, Tracy, is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
So I came to books quite late. And for most of my childhood, I just watched a lot of television, which I'm not proud of. So the book I've chosen is actually a book that I read much later in my early 20s, but it is the book that made me fall in love with books and with reading. And that is Civil Warland in Bad Decline by George Saunders. It's a short story collection. And I think what I loved so much about it and continue to love about it is that it is so funny. And it was the first time I'd read a book that I was like, oh my God, this is comedy gold. You know, I always thought that books had to be, you know, serious in nature, like in the themes they wrote about and the character dialogue had to be, you know, serious people having serious conversations. And then to read the characters in Civil Warland in Bad Decline, you know, it was just so goofy, so funny, and yet full of heart as well. And that definitely ignited my love for reading.
I think about quitting. Then I think about my last degrading batch of resumes. 200 send-outs and no nibbles. My feeling is that prospective employers are put off by the fact that I was a lowly verisimilitude inspector for 9 years with no promotions. I think of my car payment. I think of how much Marcus and Howie love the little playhouse I'm still paying off. Once again, I decide to eat my pride and sit tight. So I wipe off my tie with a leaf and start down to break the Haverstrom news to Mr. L. Suga. Mr. A is another self-made man. He cashed in on his love of history by conceptualizing Civil Warland in his spare time. He started out with just a settler's shack and one Union costume, and now has considerable influence in Rotary. His office is in City Hall. He agrees that the gangs are getting out of hand. Last month, they wounded 3 visitors and killed a dray horse. Several of them encircled and made fun of Mrs. Dugan and her settler outfit as she was taking her fresh-baked bread over to the simulated town meeting. No way they're paying admission, so they're either tunneling in or coming in over the retaining wall. Mr. Alsuga believes the solution to the gang problem is teen groups. I tell him that's basically what a gang is, a teen group. But he says, how can it be a teen group without an adult mentor with a special skill like whittling? Mr. Alsuga whittles. Once he gave an old-time skills seminar on it in the blacksmith shop. It was poorly attended. All he got was 2 widowers and a chess club type no gang would have wanted anyway. And myself. I attended. Evelyn called me a bootlicker, but I attended. She called me a bootlicker, and I told her she'd better bear in mind which side of the bread her butter was on. She said whichever side it was on, it wasn't enough to shake a stick at. She's always denigrating my pay stub. I came home from the seminar with this kind of whittled duck. She threw it away the next day because she said she thought it was an acorn. It looked nothing like an acorn. As far as I'm concerned, she threw it away out of spite. It made me livid, and twice that night I had to step into a closet and perform my hatred abatement breathing. But that's neither here nor there.
Civil Warland in Bad Decline by George Saunders is available in audio commercially, read by the author, with an introduction read by Joshua Ferris. And is there a book that on a rainy day you curl up with again and again to reread?
I think assuming that the rainy day lasts for a week, it'd probably be Shuggy Bane by Douglas Stewart. Again, just another very comforting read that, you know, you get to spend so much time with these characters, you become so invested in them, and things move slowly, but it's written in such a way that you want it to move slow because you don't want it to end. And when it does, you know, Douglas Stewart sticks the landing. It's the most rewarding ending. But yeah, it's one of those books that you just want to be with for a long time.
The day was flat. That morning, his mind had abandoned him and left his body wandering down below. The empty body went listlessly through its routine, pale and vacant-eyed under the fluorescent strip lights, as his soul floated above the aisles and thought only of tomorrow. Tomorrow was something to look forward to. Shuggy was methodical in setting up for his shift. All the pots of oily dips and spreads were decanted into clean trays. The edges were wiped free of any splashes that would go brown quickly and ruin the illusion of freshness. The sliced hams were artfully arranged with fake parsley sprigs, and the olives were turned so that the viscous juice slid like mucus over their green skins. Anne McGee had the brass neck to call in sick again that morning, leaving him with the thankless task of running his deli counter and her rotisserie stand all alone. No day ever started well with 6 dozen raw chickens, and today of all days, it was stealing the sweetness out of his daydreams. He pushed industrial skewers through each cold, dead bird and lined them up neatly in a row. They sat there with their stubby wings crossed over their fat little chests like so many headless babies. There was a time he would have taken pride in this orderliness. In reality, pushing the metal through the bumpy pink flesh was the easy part. The difficult part was resisting the urge to do the same to the customers. They would pore over the hot glass and study each of the carcasses in detail. They would choose only the best bird, ignorant to the fact that battery farming meant they were all identical. Shuggy would stand there, his back teeth pinching the inside of his cheek, and indulge their indecisiveness with a forced smile. Then the pantomime would really begin.
Geese 3 breasts, 5 thighs, and just 1 wing the day, son.
Shuggy Bane by Douglas Stewart is available in audio both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books, as narrated by Angus King.
And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be contemporary, but something you've read recently you'd like to recommend.
Yes, I would recommend More Than You'll Ever Know by Katie Gutierrez. It came out this year. It's definitely available in the UK now. And it's just such a wonderful combination of like being a crime thriller whilst also having very well-developed characters. It's a story about a woman who was married to 2 men at the same time, kept them a secret from each other until one of them found out and murdered the other. And now we're following a true crime writer in present day who's gone to track this woman down to try to tell her story. So it's about like fidelity and relationships and female desire and motherhood, and then the ethics of true crime as well. So it's about a lot of things, but it's such a juicy, fun read that I would absolutely recommend.
By the time I read about Lore Rivera, my mother had been dead for 12 years. Dead, but not gone. She was like my shadow, angling dark and long in the right light, inescapable and untouchable. Everyone had loved my mother. She was a 3rd grade teacher who'd once told our class that history was written by those who had power and wanted to keep it. So, when you read your textbooks, ask yourself who is telling the story and what they have to gain by your believing it. My classmates had looked at me then, awed by my mother's educational subterfuge, and I'd smiled, proud she was mine, that I had come from her. Every Friday night, she and I curled up together on the nubby tweed couch to watch Dateline. Sometimes our fingers brushed as we worked the matted tassels of our favorite blue blanket, and we giggled softly, as if catching each other in the act of something private. Then we'd wait for Stone Phillips, with his strong jaw and serious eyes, to reveal the endless ways one human being can harm another. This was the mid-90s in Enid, Oklahoma, still some time before my 9th birthday. My life was still ordinary. I hadn't yet learned that ordinary could be precious. So I got my thrills from watching the Dateline camera pan over photos of smiling blonde women riding bikes and cutting wedding cakes, oblivious to their own tragic ends. I couldn't help but see myself in them, or see myself the way the camera might see me, a dead girl still living. I breathed in my mother's scent of snuff cigarettes and chalk dust as she pulled me against her side. And maybe that was the pleasure that started it all. From that nubby tweed couch, I explored an other world of danger without ever leaving the safety of my mother's warmth, thrilled in the closeness of the wolf's breath against a home made of brick. Except, it turns out brick walls don't matter when the wolf lives inside. Later, once I stopped watching Dateline with my mother, once I stopped doing anything at all with her, I checked true crime books out of the Enid Public Library 3 or 4 at a time, slipping them into my backpack like contraband. I devoured In Cold Blood and Helter Skelter the way I imagined boys my age looked at porn, all that furtive grasping under covers. I was grasping for something, too. Some kind of dark knowledge, understanding. I slid my hands over their plastic covers, greased with fingerprints like mine. I read the other names on the borrowing cards. Jennifer, Nicole, Emily, and wondered if they too read about serial killers beneath the golden dome of their covers, grateful for something more frightening than their father's voice bleeding through the walls.
More Than You'll Ever Know by Katie Gutierrez is available both commercially and in the RNIB Talking Books Library, as read by Yareli Arizmendi and Ines del Castillo.
And Trace to the End, thank you once again.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for today's show. Remember to tune in at the same time next week for more book news, reviews, and author interviews. And if you want to catch up with our previous shows, just type RNIB Read On into your favourite search engine. I can be found on Twitter at @talking_books. And remember to join me every day of the week on RNIB Connect Radio for our sister show, Talking Books. The full schedule can be found at rnibconnectradio.org.uk.